Welcome to Nikonians Talk Radio. We're the Image Doctors. I'm Jason O'Dell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
Thanks for joining us today. It's the 23rd of February. And today our show is brought to you by the Nikonians Digital Workshops, available at www.greaterphoto.com. If you're looking to learn how to use your new D70, Photoshop, Nikon Capture, and just get better pictures, including using ITTL Flash, sign up for one of our North American workshops held all throughout 2006 and coming soon to a city near you. That's www.greaterphoto.com. So what's going on in the news today, Rick, since our last show?
Well, there's some new product announcements, and we'll be seeing a lot more of those with PMA coming up quite soon. Tamron put out an announcement of three new lenses, 17-50 f2.8 DX lens. That should be quite popular.
I think so.
Yeah. A 28-200 3.8-5.6, as well as a 70-300 f4-5.6 macro. And, of course, all of these are, quote, optimized for digital, which usually means a little bit better coatings and things of that sort. Now, the first one is a nice alternative to the Nikon 17-55. Now, there were some rumors going around before this lens came out that it was, in fact, the same lens as the Nikon one. And, you know, we've heard that kind of thing before. They're not. It's a different lens, different number of elements inside. You know, it's a different optical configuration. But Tamron does make some nice lenses.
So, absolutely.
You know, we're looking forward to hearing more about that one. The other thing, you want to mention the other podcast that's just recently out.
That's right. If you haven't already subscribed, we released our latest interview podcast in the Behind the Lens series. Our very own Jeff Bishop had a chance to sit down with world-renowned travel photographer Bob Crist and spent a good chunk of time with him, asking him about his style of photography. And if you haven't heard about Bob Crist, he's been on the cover of National Geographic. That says enough right there.
Yeah.
But he's a very famous travel photographer. He shoots for all kinds of magazines, and it's a really interesting interview. We encourage you to go to podcasts.nikonians.org and download the Behind the Lens series.
Yep. One of my favorite photographers. Now, the next thing is PMA, and we are going to be heading down there very soon.
That's right.
Yeah, we'll be in place just a few days after this podcast comes out. In fact, that's when it'll crank up. And one of the things that we're planning to do is record a podcast down there at PMA and talk about some of the announcements.
We will be the mobile unit for the Image Doctors. It's kind of like, you know, a traveling, you know, like a MASH tent. The Image Doctors will be in our own little. But the Nikonians booth, for anybody visiting PMA, which is in the Orlando, the Orange County Convention Center, starts on this coming Saturday, the 26th of February, I think. Runs through Wednesday, March 1st. And Nikonians has a little booth there, number 1759. Come down and say hi. You can meet us, meet the owners of Nikonians, not to mention see all the other cool exhibits from all the imaging industry. So it's not open to the general public, but if you have some kind of credential as a professional photographer, you can get into the PMA show for a small fee.
Yep, so hopefully you'll be able to stop by and see us.
And we're going to roam around and try to do some you know, live recording. We have our aerial recording. Our helicopter is going to be, well, maybe not, Learjet. Someday we'll get a Learjet.
Perhaps simulated.
It's a highly simulated aerial podcast there. But we'll tell you about all the new products as they're announced, and hopefully we'll have a chance to play with some of the toys as well. I want to get my hands on, personally, the 18-200 VR lens and try that out myself.
And after that, we're going to spend a few extra days down in Florida and go photograph some birds and other wildlife. Both over in the Merritt Island area and up at St. Augustine, at the St. Augustine Alligator Farm, actually.
That's right, and we will have a full report on those locations in our podcast. We're going to try to probably end up bumping our schedule, right, Rick?
Yep.
Due to us being out of town and doing an extra podcast next week at PMA, look for the Image Doctors podcast to return to its normal biweekly schedule on the 16th of March. Now, we got a bunch of listener mail over the last couple of weeks that have asked us a bunch of questions all around the similar theme, and that is, I'm new to photography, or I'm thinking about going digital from film. What should I get? What should I do? And we wanted to devote most of this episode today to talking about someone who's new to digital SLRs.
Yeah. Now, if you're someone that's experienced in that, don't automatically just shut off the podcast right now.
Right. Don't turn us out yet.
Because if you're like us, you get a lot of questions from friends too. So hopefully this will give you some ideas about what to talk to them about and maybe broaden the range of potential ideas that you can share with some friends. So
I know I get questions all the time. Hey, yep. You're a good photographer. What should I buy, or what should I get for my mom for Christmas, or what should I?
Exactly. So let's talk a little bit about that. Let's go down the path of someone being relatively new to photography in general, and then also, you know, what someone that's had some experience with film and is migrating over to digital is going to experience.
Okay, so what we would like to do with this topic is to start off with what to look for, what to buy. We'll make some equipment recommendations. Obviously, a lot of this will be personal choice.
Yeah, and I think you have to recognize what situation are you or a friend in right now.
Mm-hmm.
Are you just interested in getting better pictures of your family and friends and some vacation shots? Or are you really thinking that this will be a serious thing in the long run, and therefore you want to buy something that you can scale up and that's going to be useful to you in a longer term?
Right.
Both are fine. There's one isn't bad and the other good. They're just different. So you have to be sure that you're recognizing what your true interests are or your friends.
Right.
And don't try to steer them toward the serious thing if that's really not what they want.
The bottom line is that no matter, you know, what camera you're looking into invest in, we're assuming you've reached the state, or your friend has reached the state of mind where they want to get an SLR camera. And even the cheapest digital SLRs are still several hundred dollars. And by the time you add a lens on there, it's a substantial investment for most people, even getting the consumer grade lenses. So it's going to seem like, you know, whereas you could say $1,000 for a camera, that's nothing. Well, to a lot of people, that's
an awful lot of money.
That's a hell of a lot of money, and we gotta think about that. Now, there's sort of there's two kinds of people. Let's start with the person, if this is you or your friends or relatives, the person who right now does not own a film camera, or if they did, maybe it was a point-and-shoot film camera. Maybe they own a point-and-shoot digital camera, and you want to start getting into photography and experiment with it. Is maybe just this is your first foray into, I want to start taking photographs more than just snapshots.
But you're not anticipating, you know, spending a huge amount of time.
Right. This is going to be your it's not just your first digital SLR. It might be your first SLR camera.
Mm-hmm.
You've never shot a film SLR. You've never shot slides or anything like that. You're coming straight from, at most, a digital point and shoot.
Right. And you might have some SD cards or something like that.
Correct.
As a result.
Now, Rick, what would we suggest for this person? What are they going to have to expect to do?
Well, in that situation, I would suggest looking at the D50. I think it's an excellent camera. The image quality is quite high. It's just as good as the other camera that we'll talk about, the D70S, where we'll talk a little bit more about serious interests. But it's solid. It feels great. It works quite well. I think what I would recommend is looking at getting the 18-70 DX lens with it, as opposed to the 18-55, just a little bit more range, a little bit better solidity. But the 18-55 is certainly an option.
Yeah, and the D50 comes in a couple of configurations, right? You can buy it the body only, which is going to run you about $550.
And by the way, we're going to talk about U.S. dollars, so we apologize
right.
in advance. But hopefully you'll be able to scale all these options to whatever currency you're operating in.
Yes. So in the United States, a D50 body costs about $550, and it's sort of comes in two prepackaged kits. One kit is with the, I think it's the 18-55
right.
DX, and then there's a second kit which comes with that lens and then the 50 to 200 DX. Now, neither of those lenses are bad. They're just not quite as good optically as the 18 to 70 DX lens, which is a standard as a kit lens on the D70. If you want to order that lens, you're going to have to buy it piecemeal. Most of the time, it's not going to be sold as a kit. The different kits, if you want it with the basic kit with the 18 to 55 will run you $650 US, or you can get the two lens kit with the D50 for about $800 US. Your mileage may vary depending on your retailer. On the other hand, an 18 to 70 DX lens will cost you about $340, $350 US. So you're looking at probably with one lens, you know, almost, you know, $800 kit. One thing you should also consider is, you know, the memory. If you're moving up from point and shoot, one of the reasons why we're suggesting the D50 is that if you've already got some secure digital SD digital cards, you can use those in your D50. The other Nikon digitals all use compact flash.
Yeah.
So that's just something to think about. You'll be able to maybe use your pre-existing cards as backups. How much memory should someone be looking at when they're getting a digital camera?
Well, I think with these with cameras with about 6 megapixels,
which
is what we're talking about with the D50 and a D70S, you can get by just fine with a 1 gigabyte card. That works pretty well. However, prices have really dropped on these things, and you can get some nice 2 gigabyte cards for not that much more. So that's probably what I would recommend. I think it's the sweet spot in terms of capacity versus price. Would you agree on that, Jason?
I would have to agree, and especially right now with compact flash and secure digital have come down where you can get a 2 gig card for about $100.
It's amazing.
$50 a gigabyte, you know, might as well. Now, we're also going to assume for those of you on the point-and-shoot side, if you've already got some secure digital cards, it would be probably in your best interest to think about get a slightly larger capacity one for the D50 and use your other ones, which may be only 256 or 512 megs. Use those as the backup cards.
Yeah.
Having a second card is a good idea
it
in
is
general,
smart.
But if you can only, you know, if this is your only purchase, you're going to have to at least think about it in your budget. Put in an extra $100 probably for a memory card because
right.
You're going to need one regardless of which route you take.
Right. Now, if you're wanting to also photograph, you know, some wildlife, things like that, you'll want to think about getting something like a 70 to 300 millimeter lens or something like that.
Right.
As just
you probably wouldn't
addition.
Get by with just 18 to 70
no,
or 18
it'll
to 55.
Work great for family shots, vacation shots, things like that. But if you do want to do some wildlife, you'll want to go to the 70 to 300. Now, one thing I definitely would mention is that with these cameras, 35 millimeter type lenses, which maybe you have from some previous thing, are going to behave a little bit differently. They're going to have an equivalent focal length of about 1.5 times longer. That's true for regular lenses. That's true for DX lenses. There's no difference there. So if you have something like a 28 to 55 or 28 to 70 that, you know, might have worked well for some previous Nikon body, it's going to be the equivalent of something longer. So I think you're going to want to get something like an 18 to 55 or an 18 to 70. That's my guess.
Right. Now, let's point out, I mean, if you're new to digital, and you've probably heard this term thrown around with crop factor, it doesn't increase the magnification of your lens. It reduces the angle of view of your lens.
But really doesn't matter.
With the digital sensors these days, the quality is so good, you're effectively getting the equivalent of a lens that's 1.5 times longer. The actual focal length that's marked on the lens, whether it's a DX lens designed for digital sensors or a 35 millimeter lens designed for film, the focal length is the same. If it says 18 to 70, that's the focal
that's
length in millimeters. What you hear people saying, this multiplication stuff, is just to... We're so used to thinking about angle of view in 35 millimeter terms that it's convenient to say my 100 millimeter lens on film behaves as a 150 millimeter lens
right.
on digital. The focal length didn't change. The angle of view changed.
Yeah. And we won't spend any more time on it.
No, it's just
so
you can be aware of that.
Yeah.
Now, the other person out there, maybe you've already been shooting film. So you're not looking at getting an SLR for the first time. you're looking at moving into digital. What would be something good for these people, Rick?
Well, I think in that case, you know, there are a number of options. I mean, you could go all the way from, you know, a D50 up to a D2X, I guess. But I think if you're trying to do it more on a budget and you have some interest in photography, and yeah, then the D70S is a wonderful camera, actually. I mean, the images are great coming out of it, make very nice prints. And it's more cost-effective than something like a D200, which would be the next step up in the line.
Right. For the same price as the D200 body, you can get an entire D70S outfit with one or more lenses and be taking great pictures.
Right. Now, the body alone is about $800 in the U.S. right now, maybe just slightly above that, depending on where you get it from. The kit that a lot of people buy with a D70S is the one that includes the 18-70.
Which is a very highly recommended lens.
Very nice lens, nice and solid. And that'll run you about $1,100. You could add on a 70-300, and of course that would take it up to around $1,400 approximately.
Mm-hmm. That'd give you a good range
for the price. But there is one other option that's a newer one that you could consider if the budget's worked out. And that's going with a single lens and the 18-200 VR lens. That would take the package up to about $1,550 or so. But in return, you're getting a lens that has very good feedback so far in its performance. It has VR, and nothing that we've talked about so far has vibration reduction, which will help you in lower light situations where you're having to handhold the lens.
Right.
And not quite as much length on the long end, but not bad either when you consider that 1.5 crop factor.
Exactly. You'll be able to cover with that one lens pretty much all the normal situations that you would find yourself in as a new, you know, starting photographer.
Yeah.
Enough on the telephoto end to get detailed pictures of whatever it is, if it's the deer out there on the field or something, or your kids running around on the soccer field. And then enough on the wide end so that you can do some nice landscapes and group shots.
And so if you like the idea of one lens that kind of does it all, you don't have to switch it out.
Fits in your bag, mm-hmm. compact kit.
That's a good way to go. We've already talked about some accessories, specifically the memory cards.
Well, let's just summarize here
before
we get into that.
Sure.
I think we should just sort of summarize the two differences. So if you're starting out the photography and you've got a point and shoot, our recommendation is a D50 camera. Not all of the same features. It's a little slimmed down from the D70. D70 is probably better for someone who's going to think that this is a little bit more serious hobby already. I already have maybe some experience in photography, and I'm probably going to upgrade in the future.
Right.
The biggest difference being the form factor of the memory cards these cameras take. A few other things that you get better with the D70.
Yeah, and the two most important things in my mind are depth of field preview.
Right, that's a good thing.
Which you can use to judge how out of focus a background is. That'll help, as we're going to talk later about that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, in my opinion, important. And a little bit easier to operate controls in manual exposure settings. You actually get a separate shutter speed dial and aperture dial, which is nice. Mm-hmm. It's not essential, but it is handy when you're shooting that way.
And I just think, like, if you're thinking about this is not going to be my last digital SLR, then getting into the path where you can say, I've just spent some money on 2, 3, 4, 5 gigabytes worth of memory cards. I don't want to have to buy all new memory cards when I upgrade this to a D200 down the line.
Right.
That's where a D70 might also be, you know, consider that.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as like the images you will get out of either of these cameras, both are going to produce excellent images. It has more to do with the lenses you put on the front of them than the cameras themselves.
And quite honestly, talking about the memory cards, it's amazing how quickly things are changing. 3 months ago, that was a bigger deal because card prices were higher.
Well, actually, they're more like 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, 2 weeks ago. So they're plummeting, so it's becoming less of an issue. It could be that in 6 months' time, it's almost a don't care, but at least right now,
I recently indulged in a new 4 gigabyte card, ooh, which I paid exactly half of what I paid for that card 6 months ago.
Yeah,
so it's really come down in price. So those are your two options. I mean, you're going to have to buy a body and you're going to have to buy a lens. Now you're in the store and you're going to say, you know, what other things should I get? Well, we've already mentioned memory.
Mm-hmm.
You know, get one or two cards. Make sure you've got enough. And like what we said, about 2 gigabytes should be enough for 99% of your situations. Do you need a spare battery? Possibly, but with these cameras, they have very good track records with battery life.
Yeah,
so that's something you could wait on.
Yeah, if you're good about checking your battery capacity at the end of the day and you can take your charger with you, it's not quite as critical to have a spare, but they're nice to have.
Right.
Because sometimes you'll forget.
Now, the one other thing that you might be talked into is some filters.
Mm-hmm.
There's only really one filter that we recommend for your lens to have as an option, and that's the circular polarizing filter.
Right, and that will definitely make a difference in some shots where you want to enhance the sky, really darken the blue of the sky, take reflections off of rocks and
leaves,
and anything that might have a little bit of moisture on it.
What about a UV protective filter, Rick?
You know, I'm almost afraid to go there because it's a borderline religious topic, and you'll find people that have really strong opinions about using them. Now, I know you don't use them. I don't use them either. I've been using an SLR since I was 12 years old, and that was just a little bit more than 30 years ago. I've never, ever, ever scratched lens or even come close to it. But
in most cases, the lens hood will provide a fair amount of protection.
And I'm good about putting my lens cap on. So I don't use them. One of the reasons is I have a fair number of lenses, and it would be expensive, quite honestly, for me to buy a lot of filters that, at least so far in 30 years, I've never needed. But I have another rationale, too. When you do want to use a polarizer, or if you want to use a graduated neutral density filter, it's a pain in the neck to get the UV off and the other one on. You really don't want to stack them. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, a good friend of mine who's in the process of buying a D50, he has an older, I think it's a F65 or something like that camera. He had been told to get a UV protective filter, and he also had a polarizer. I can't remember what happened with the UV, but he had problems with it. And then he had put the polarizer on as protection. Well, we couldn't get it off.
Oh, no.
The darn thing got stuck, and it's more likely to happen with less expensive lenses that have plastic threads. But it was stuck, and we could not get it off for the life of us because
we didn't
have a filter wrench handy. And that does happen on occasion. You'll get it jammed on there, and then either you're stuck, with the wrong lens on, filter on, or whatever.
Right.
So I don't know.
I think my philosophy on any filter, you can get what you want. My recommendation, of course, circular polarizers. Spend a little bit extra getting the multi-coated version of the filter. Don't get the cheapest one because you've put a lot of money into high quality coated optics in your lens. Why put a cheap piece of glass that is uncoated and going to give you ghosting and reflections and all kinds of potential pitfalls? Protective filters do serve one excellent purpose that I wouldn't disagree with. If you're going to be near water and spray and stuff, you want to protect your lens from the spray. That makes a lot of sense because then you just get it on the filter. But usually when you look in for the filters, there'll be the regular version, and then there'll be something called the MC or multi-coated version.
Yeah.
Stick with the multi-coated version because it'll just be that much better down the road and you won't have to upgrade it.
It does make a difference.
And they're not that much more expensive.
So if you do get a UV protective filter, get a multi-coated one. We'll leave it at that.
Okay. What about a flash?
Well, the cameras that we mentioned, the D50 and the D70S, both have a small built-in flash. And that'll work all right for a number of things as long as the distance to your subject isn't too long. It'll also work well in fill flash situations outside. And that fill flash, which just adds a little bit of light to your subjects, really can improve them, especially when you have subjects that are backlit, maybe your kids or something like that. And so that'll suffice for a while. A separate flash, though, can offer some advantages. One, you're less likely to have problems with red eye, unless you've got, red eye reduction going on. And even then,
it doesn't always work as well.
And the reason is that the flash sits up a little bit higher, and you end up with a little bit more of distance between the lens and the flash, and that's what influences red eye. Also, you can do some techniques like bounce flash, which you cannot do with the built-in flashes on those cameras. And that'll give you much more natural lighting. If you're not familiar with it, what you do is you angle the flash upwards to a ceiling, or in some cases you can bounce it off of a wall. You want to make sure it's a white wall or ceiling.
Yep.
Red ones will do some nasty things in terms of color. But then the light on your subject looks far more natural and even. It really is a dramatic difference.
Absolutely.
So if you're...
But it's another, you know, it's not going to be cheap. You're talking about another $200 to $300 to get, say, an SB600 or an SB800, I think, is a little over $300.
Right.
They're great flashes. You could continue to use them with any product in the Nikon line. So it's a good kind of investment for the future.
But you
maybe
can
not
always
something
start
you
out
the first day.
Exactly. You could always just start off with a built-in flash.
They do amazing work, however.
Yeah. You know, the other things would be a nice bag, and they're... lots and lots of options there. So, you know, what I would suggest is, you know, get the equipment that you're going to be buying and then just try out several options and see what you prefer.
Yeah, don't just go with the first thing that comes to mind. Now, before we move on, because we want to talk about some tips for beginners, mm-hmm. you know, which would be photo tips as well as digital photo tips. There's a couple things we should point out. We're talking about buying, you know, what should you get? Where should you get it? There's a million places out there to get it. Your local camera store, that's a good place to go.
Yep.
They'll probably have any of these cameras in stock at any given time. These are very popular cameras. You may find a better price or save sales tax for those of you in the United States by shopping at a reputable online dealer. The key here is reputable online dealer. Trust us. Trust us on this one.
You don't want
to
be
cheap. If it's the
lowest
price, there's a catch. If it's there are a few places that we strongly recommend, some of whom, many of them who we've purchased through personally before. There's sort of a short list, but before I get to the short list, let me tell you about a place you can go online to do a little homework before you plink down the money. There's a website called resellerratings.com. That's resellerratings.com. They have user feedback from most of the internet commerce websites, especially for electronics and cameras and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
You punch in the website of that and you look at their rating. They rate them on a scale of 1 to 10. And they have a recent average and a lifetime average. Look at that rating. If that rating is not above 6, I would strongly suggest not going there.
And even then, why? You know,
there's a plenty of them out there who will have ratings of 8, 9, 10.
And you'll also be able to see what some of the typical scams are. And there are scams.
Right.
You know, when you see those low prices on a D50 or a D70S body, you know, one of the common ones is they won't necessarily tell you right away, that they'll strip out the battery, the charger, and some of the other accessories.
Which are included with the camera.
Yes, they're included with the camera. Then try to sell them to you at a price. And usually that wipes out any cost savings, or it even actually, in some cases, ends up costing you more.
Or worse, they will not advertise on their website that they're selling you a lens that is not warranted in the United States.
Or elsewhere.
Or anywhere else, for that matter.
You can have the same issue a variety of places. It's not
so
unique to the U.S.
Reputable places will often sell import items, but they will clearly mark them as such and say, this is an import item. It is not covered by the United States warranty, for example, but we will warrant it or... you know, whatever, but at least they will have their policy. So check out resellerratings.com before you see that real sweet deal. And that's just sage advice. It comes up all the time in our forums.
Yeah. Now, some places that we've had good experience with, and by the way, two of these are advertisers with Nikonian, so we're going to point that out, but two are not. So these are just our honest opinions. And quite honestly, the reason that two are advertisers is we had such good experiences with them. We
Absolutely.
Wanted to set up that relationship. But B&H and Adorama have excellent reputations.
They're reliable.
Known. Yeah, exactly. And then a couple that aren't as well known but are advertisers with us that we've had extremely good personal experiences with are Roberts and Berger Brothers.
Right.
You go with one of those four, and chances are you'll be fine. There's some other good ones out there, too, but those are just four that we've had personal success
with. I have bought from all four of those guys, and I will say they're all good. I've bought from Burger Brothers. I've bought from Roberts. I've bought from B&H and Anorama.
Yeah.
And we get great, it's as advertised. They don't play any games with you, and you'll get good customer service.
You can trust the prices to be real.
That's right. Now, moving on, we should talk about, for those of you starting out, some tips on getting better pictures, because that's really what it's all about. You've just spent $1,000 on this new camera. We assume that you're doing so because you want to move up from taking snapshots and move into the realm of taking photographs.
So we're going to talk about just a few basic things, not so many that you feel overwhelmed, hopefully, but just a few basic things that you can do that really will improve the quality of your pictures just right off the bat.
Yeah.
So now, let's quite honestly, you could do these with your point and shoot, too.
You could. You could do that. So let's start, Rick, with composition. What would you say, composing a picture? This is a lot of what makes a good photograph, right?
Right.
I mean, it's composition.
Right.
What would you say to do?
Well, I think the most important thing is figure out what your subject is. And your subject is not every single thing that's in the picture frame. That'll just be kind of confused and there won't be any impact. So as an example, if you're taking a picture of your child, then your child is that subject. And what you want to do is make sure that that subject is the predominant thing in the picture. And what that means is get close.
That's right. Get close and then get closer.
Yeah. It's probably going to feel a little bit unnatural at first. You're going to be tempted to stay back a little bit further just for a lot of psychological reasons. And they'll seem like they're kind of big in the viewfinder, but they're really not. So get a little bit closer than you would normally do.
And there's two ways to get close. You can always physically, the old-fashioned way, which is just get closer.
Right.
Or you can use your telephoto lens, zoom lens. So then you have a more comfortable distance between you and Aunt B, so you don't feel like you're in her face, but you still have a nice frame-filling picture. And those just look so much nicer.
Yeah. So the first rule is get close.
Get close.
And that always works.
What's the second rule?
Well, I think the second one.
Is there a second rule?
It's more like a guideline, actually.
A guideline,
It's a guideline. Is the what's called the rule of thirds or guideline of thirds. And what that means is don't place your subject just right in the center of your frame, bullseye style. And that's something a lot of beginning photographers do.
It's very easy to do with autofocus cameras because that sensor in the middle, right there in the middle of the picture.
It's the default one. And so some people never, move off the center. But try to place your subject at, one of the one-third or two-thirds points in your photo. And what you want to do is just think of your picture frame divided into thirds, both the horizontal and vertical axis.
Right, kind of like drawing a tic-tac-toe grid on
on
your camera.
And place your subject at one of those intersection points on that tic-tac-toe grid, just a little bit off-center. And you'll have to figure out which one works best for your subject. But do that. Avoid the dead center thing. There may be some photos where that works, but most work better at approximately the one-third points.
And to do this
to be exact.
You're going to need to learn how to lock the autofocus on your camera. And with the Nikon cameras, you can use what's called the single servo autofocus mode. You lock on the, let's say, Aunt B's face, and then slightly recompose the picture while holding the shutter down partway, and then take the picture.
Right.
That you'll just have, and that just will take a little practice, but you can do it.
Yeah. The other way you can do it is, if you're taking that picture of Aunt B, switch your sensor to one that's where Aunt B is in your final composed picture. That's the other alternative. So both can work. The next thing, what would you say, Jason, in terms of tips?
In terms of tips, I think another thing to start to get more unique pictures and start to get better compositions would be to change the height from which you are shooting. People are very used to seeing the angle or perspective from the average person height, which is somewhere between 5 and 6 feet off the ground. Say you're taking a picture of a duck, or some pigeon in a parking lot or whatever, because you just think that this will be cool. Well, how do we see that bird most of the time? Or how do we see our kids most of the time? We see them from looking down on top of them. Get down at your subject's eye level, even if your subject is a rock and doesn't have eyes. Okay,
picture
a rock with eyes. Maybe it's a pet rock, right? But get down at the subject's eye level. All of a sudden, it's going to give a new flair to your composition and a quality to those pictures that will just be a little different from everybody else's. And you'll start seeing, and some people will say, wow, that one's really good, and I'm not sure why, but you take these great pictures. Conversely, try the other way. Get high. Take a picture from a higher perspective, a higher point of view. It just changes things up in a way that will give some new style to your photographs.
Right. And then I think the last thing that we want to mention, because again, we don't want to give you a whole bunch of guidelines right off the bat, but if you're taking a photo, let's say you're on a trip or something, and you're taking a shot of a nice view, you know, from a hill or something like that, the classic problem is that you don't get anything in your foreground, and when you get your picture back, it just looks flat and uninteresting because everything's at a distance.
There's no depth to it.
There's no perspective. Depth to it. So one way or another, you want to try to get something into your foreground. Now, it could be some members of your family. It could be a nice big rock. It could be a tree. It could be a bunch of things. And what you want to do is kind of similar to what we mentioned before. Get a little bit unnaturally close. That'll make your foreground kind of pop out of the picture, and then use a small aperture. Use something like F16 or F11 or F22, and that'll help you get everything in sharp focus.
And by all means, if you find an interesting rock or potential foreground object, you can move it in a lot of cases to be more in tune with your composition.
Yeah. And then think about the rule of thirds too when you're placing your foreground interests, because that will help too.
Absolutely.
So those are a nice basic set of compositional ideas. There are a lot of other things you can do, but those will get you off to a good start and help improve the quality of your photos.
Now, moving to some more technical challenges with taking better pictures when you're going to digital camera, there's an old rule, again, rule of thumb from a long time ago, that said in order to handhold a camera, you need to use a shutter speed that is equivalent to 1 over the focal length in millimeters. So let's say you have a 100-millimeter lens. That means you would want to shoot at least 1/100th of a second shutter speed or faster for it to look sharp. Well, that rule is just a suggestion. We think a better rule, or in the digital age, we talked about how there's this crop factor, how your lenses behave as if they were longer. Stick to 1/2 times the focal length for handholding.
Right.
Unless
you
have an image stabilized lens or something like that.
Or a tripod.
Or a tripod or whatever. But if you're hand holding the camera, that means if you shoot at, use a 50-millimeter lens, try to shoot at 1/100th, 1/125th of a second.
Right.
You'll save yourself some headache later. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. And then there's some exposure things to think about when you're moving to digital, because it's a little different from film. Those are things like white balance. What's white balance, Rick?
Well, you know, it always existed as an issue with film, but in a lot of cases, we just decided it wasn't a problem or there wasn't an easy way around it in a lot of cases. But it was, you know, if you think about film images, sometimes when it was overcast, they took on a bluish tinge. If you were shooting in really warm light, like around sunrise or sunset, sometimes it looked great with the warm images, but sometimes it was too much too, and your photos would look a little bit orangish. That would also happen if you were shooting indoors and you had incandescent lights. You know, most light bulbs are
The colors would look weird.
They'd look very orange.
Or in fluorescent lights, they'd look green.
Yeah, and whether you were shooting slides or prints, you'd often get back images that were a little bit off. That just would happen. Well, the cool thing about digital SLRs is they have a white balance feature where you can offset that problem and get something that looks a little bit more natural. The way you had to do it in the past was with colored filters, like a light blue filter or maybe a light yellowish or orangish filter. A lot of people never had those, and so they just had pictures that were a little bit off. So with digital, you can fix that a little bit easier. And you can either use an automatic white balance feature, which works okay, you know, in a lot of conditions, not the more extreme ones. Or you can preset something. If you're going to shoot indoors with incandescent light sources, you can set your white balance.
Or fluorescent or daylight. There's different presets.
They work awfully well.
And they're pretty good. That being said, one of the things is, if you're new to digital, the nicest feature, but also something to be careful about is you've got that LCD on the back of the camera that's going to show you an image preview. It is very easy to say this image looks a little off with my white, you know, maybe it's a little too blue or a little bit too orange. Those LCD monitors are good for previewing the image and composition and focus. They are not as good for judging color. So don't trust it.
No, I wouldn't use it that way.
So do not trust your LCD for color. But what you should do, if there's one function you learn to use on your digital on your new digital camera, is learn to use the histogram function to judge exposure. Now, we don't have time to go into histogram today. We'll probably do that on another show. But there's an excellent article in the Nikonian's resource pages, resources.nikonians.org, on understanding your digital camera's histogram.
Very powerful tool.
It's an excellent tool. It allows you to basically judge the exposure. You can't trust your LCD because you can adjust the brightness and the LCD panel itself. What you try to avoid, if there's one rule about exposure in digital, you have to avoid what's called blowing the highlights. With a digital camera,
it's a lot like slide film.
It's a lot like slide film. There is a value, you know, the colors are represented by numbers in RGB color space, whatever. As soon as you get a value of pure white, there's no information there whatsoever, and you lose all texture. You lose any information. It's gone. It's just not there. There's no way to recover it.
You cannot go up to 11.
You can't, no, that's right. Our show sometimes goes to 11, but your digital camera does not.
Right.
So you need to check that, and using the histogram will allow you to understand if you're blowing the highlights. The Nikon cameras have this neat little feature where you can turn on blinking highlights. It'll show you
That's
in your preview
feature.
That you've blown. Now, sometimes
you can see where they're blinking, and maybe it's a don't care area or too
right.
small.
But so maybe it's feathers of a white bird, and you want to have that some detail there. So use
so
that, and then go back
that.
And correct your exposure. So that's what we would suggest.
Yeah. Now, quick discussion on post-processing.
Right,
that's the next step. What do you do with these images, and what file formats do mm-hmm. you record them in? Here's what I would say. If you're in the category of you just want to get some good family photos and you're not going to get too serious about it and you really don't want to invest a lot of time on the computer, then you know shooting in the JPEG format, which is a nice compact format, will work pretty well. Now, the only issue with shooting in a JPEG format is the settings that you used in the camera, the time you make the shot, are the ones that you're stuck with forever.
Like the white balance,
the tone, anything
like that.
Now, you can do some tricks in Photoshop later on to help with some of that, but it's usually something that will potentially degrade the image. In some cases, it'll be really obvious. In other cases, not quite so much. But if you're not wanting to mess with a lot of stuff, JPEG is a good way to go. And that way you can even take your card out, drop it off at Walmart, whatever. It's pretty
darn easy.
That's right.
Make prints from it.
Now, if you're really wanting to learn photography a little bit more seriously, and you do want to invest a little bit of time to get the best image, then what I would recommend is right from the start shooting in RAW. And I think both of us would recommend, as a brand new photographer, that you invest in Nikon Capture.
Absolutely.
Now, here's why I say that. If you choose to with Capture, you can have it produce JPEGs or TIFFs from those raw images that look just like the JPEGs would have. And it's because it's using all the in-camera settings. If you're using some form of automatic tone compensation or even some fixed tone compensation setting.
Noise reduction, sharpening, all
those
features that you set in the camera.
Those will stay there. And so you can get images, if you want, that will require very little interaction. Not terribly different than what you would have done with JPEGs. But if you want to, you can start playing around with some of those parameters and see what it would have done with your image. You can get on your computer and say, hey, what if I'd used a different tone compensation setting? Maybe medium-low rather than medium. What would that look like? You can try it and see it out. You can't do that easily with the other RAW converters, at least not in the same frame of reference that you use your Nikon SLR.
Right. I mean, I think, and we're saying this from a first purchase standpoint.
Right.
You may find later on the line that you like other RAW converters and other software, like Get a Copy of Photoshop or Photoshop Elements. Those are great programs that do a lot of good things. But if you want to use the same terminology and have the RAW converter read the as-shot settings from your camera in the best possible way, Nikon capture is the only way to do that.
And by the way, even after, you know, 2.5 years now with the digital SLR, I still use capture and still like it probably better than any other RAW converter in terms of image quality. It's a pain in the neck in terms of workflow compared to some other things. It's not as fast. That's why if I am ever in a situation where I have a whole lot of images that where I need to process all of them, I'll use the converter that's part of Photoshop CS2. But for smaller quantities, I like capture still.
Yeah, it's a nice converter. Nice converter.
So I would recommend investing in it because it'll help you with your learning curve in digital. And there is a learning curve.
Yeah. Now, we've been yammering away here for 45 minutes. Unbelievable. And if you're still awake with us after all of that, we just have one little thing we want to bring out, some pitfalls. This is in reference to a lot of not only emails that we get from our listeners. It's in the forums. Just people are new to digital, and they are moving to maybe a higher resolution camera, or they're getting a digital
image.
Like a
D200 or a D2X.
Exactly. And they're saying, my images are not sharp, and I'm viewing them at 100% on the screen. What the heck is wrong here? Why is this expensive camera not producing sharp results?
Well, and first of all, we're not going to say that there are never issues with cameras or lenses.
Let's just assume for the moment that you're doing most of the things right, that you're that you're focusing properly, and you're using the appropriate shutter speed, etc. Remember, with a higher resolution camera, there's just more pixels there to detect motion shake. And if you want to get a really good image, you're going to have to take a lot of care in making sure that you've used good optics on a tripod, and all those things still apply. But let's just go back to understanding for a minute what viewing at 100% on the screen, like when you view actual pixels on your screen in Photoshop or Capture or any of your other programs that you might be looking at, what are you really doing there? It's really easy to do it, and we all love doing it. We all zoom right in. I mean, come on.
We're as bad as anyone else.
Absolutely. I do it all the time. And we're not going to say that you can't get a sharp image at 100% magnification.
No, you can.
You can. It's just harder. But let's take a minute to describe what that is that you're actually doing. On my computer screen here at home in the Nikonian studio, I have about 100 DPI output.
The famous Nikonian
The famous studio. Nikonians in our mountain stronghold.
Yeah. Okay. Which looks a lot like someone's bedroom, actually. But
that's right. Well, what can you do?
Yeah.
My screen's about 100 dots per inch resolution.
Right.
And a lot of good LCD screens are somewhere between that or 96, and the real low ones would be 72 dots per inch. But let's assume you're somewhere around 95 to 100 dots per inch of screen resolution on your monitor. Well, at 100%, you are effectively looking at an image that would be blown up to, on my, from a D2X now, 45 inches wide by 30 inches high.
That's huge.
That's enormous. And we're looking at that image from about normal viewing distance to the computer screen, which is 2 or 3 feet.
Yep.
At most, you know.
Now let's
go look at a poster from 3 feet, 2 feet away,
right,
and you tell me what you think.
Yeah. So if that is truly what your output product is, maybe it's a good way to judge how you're going to like it. But more often than not, it's far more zooming in than is really appropriate. And I'll use the example of what I used to do, which is examining slides or negatives under a loop. And the loop that I have is a really nice one. It's a Schneider, a spherical one. It's pretty popular. It's a 4X loop.
Okay.
You know, that's
let's put it in perspective.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you're looking at your slide, you put it on the light box, and it looks really nice. You say, oh, wow, that's a really great, I've done it plenty of times. And then I get out the magnifier, 4X, maybe 8X.
Yeah, let's stretch to an 8X.
We'll go to 8X zoom, and you say, okay, there's some softness there that didn't look as good, so maybe that one's not a keeper. And you say, oh, well, this one's still sharp at 8X. How does that compare, looking at a slide with a loop at 8X, how does that compare to our Photoshop exercise? Well, based on what I did, some calculations with a D2X file again, the looking at a slide view would be 2% magnification. And so that means I'm magnifying it 50X to get up to 100.
Right.
And so my 8X view is somewhere around 12 to 15% view in Photoshop.
Yeah, don't worry about the exact numbers.
No, it's just rough.
It's the concept.
It's the concept. So if I'm starting,
100% is really high magnification.
The only way I could get a 50X view of a slide was to stick it under my microscope, which would give me a nice view of film grain clouds.
Right.
Okay. that's the same thing as 100%. So it just shows you that.
Again, we're not saying don't ever do it.
No.
You know, we'd be lying to you if we told you that we don't. But you have to stay practical about it. And just because an image doesn't look perfect at 100% doesn't mean that you won't get a nice print. I've got some images where, you know, one case I was photographing some seals from a boat that was going up and down in the ocean, and even though I had a VR lens, the images are not sharp at 100%. It looks darn good at 8 by 12 inches, though, in the print size.
Right.
It really does.
And when your prints aren't looking sharp enough for you, then you have some room for concern, and you have to think about what it is that you're doing right. But just don't make the blank – don't do the knee-jerk response of saying, gosh, it's a little sharp, fuzzy here.
Stay practical.
That's right. Well, that's probably all I have time for today. In our next show, you're going to hear us. We'll be reporting live from the PMA show in Orlando. And then on the – we've got a few things lined up for our next real show after that, which, like we said, will be on the 16th of March.
Right.
We're going to talk a little bit about a new Photoshop plugin from Alien Skin Software called Exposure.
Both of us have tried it, and it's cool.
It is very cool.
I like it.
We'll also give a review on our shooting experience at the Merritt Island National Wildlife Refuge and the St. Augustine Alligator Farm.
Yeah, so there we're going to talk a little bit more about shooting situations and
what to do and
that kind of thing. So it should be fun. We're both looking forward to doing that.
And before we leave, let's just point out that if you want to get more information or if you've recently purchased a digital camera and you want to learn more about how to use it, check out www.greaterphoto.com and consider signing up for one of our Nikonians digital workshops in North America. They're held in a variety of cities, and they cover the D70 camera, Photoshop, Capture, and ITTL Flash. And you can do one or all of those subjects over a course of, I think, 2 or 3 days, depending on how much or how little you want to do.
It's a great way to get just a rapid increase in your photographic skills.
Yeah, you'll come out of that ahead. So take a look at that. So until next time, from Rick and myself, we will see you next time on Nikonians Talk Radio.
Thanks for listening.
All right, bye-bye.
Always look on the light side of life. If life seems jolly rotten, there's something you've forgotten, and that's to laugh and smile and dance and sing. When you're feeling in the dumps, don't be silly chumps. Just purse your lips and whistle, that's the thing. Ain't